Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 177 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember that you'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support that you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my show, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. I'd like to thank you all for giving me a month off. I hope that you missed me and missed the show. I was traveling the world for work and pleasure and discovered that due to time zones and shaky internet and phones, it was impossible to tape episodes. But I also needed the rest. So now I've returned, refreshed, and anxious to tape some more really great episodes. Seems like episode 200 is not that far away. Seems hard to believe. Now for some feedback. Bob wrote, I know that preparation is required, but is talking on the radio all that different from talking on the phone? Well, maybe you don't get interrupted as often. P.S. Congratulations on the show. Well, that's kind of an interesting question. I mean, in a way, I'm talking on the phone when I do these interviews. Normally, they're taped over the phone. But it is really different to do an interview than to just have a normal conversation, because I obviously feel responsible for keeping the conversation going. And at times I've had guests who I have to drag the information out of. And at other times I have guests that just want to keep on talking, and sometimes they get off topic and I want to try to stop them without being rude. So I think it's a little bit like doing two or three things at once. I'm trying to listen to everything the guest says. I'm trying to keep track of the questions that I have. And it's sometimes impossible to do all of those things. And I know one thing I've noticed on a lot of radio shows is that sometimes the host will ask a question that the guest has already answered, because the host was obviously focusing on something else. And that's an unfortunate reality, but I think it gets better with time. And when I listen to my episodes, and I do listen to most of my own episodes as kind of a form of quality control, I'm reasonably pleased with what I hear, and sometimes I think, oh, okay, I should improve that. I could do better there. There's something that I say too often, like, or something like that, and I need to stop doing that. Second feedback from Christian via Patreon. Hi, David. I suggest you spell the URL on your podcast for making donations. Well, let's do it. Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. patreon.com/infectiousmyth, one word. Christian continues, you have a fantastic show. I appreciate your contrarian points of view and agree with nearly all of them. I hope you'll keep up the great work. Well, I do plan to keep up doing interviews. There's a tremendous number of interesting people in the world, and my criteria for choosing guests are they have to be interesting, they have to be intelligent, they have to be educated, and they have to be the kind of people that aren't being covered by the mainstream media, because there are some subjects that the mainstream media does a really good job of covering. And what I'm interested in is the stories that the mainstream media won't touch, such as contrarian views on HIV/AIDS or vaccines or war or many other things, where I think there's a lot of people in this world who have really worthwhile points of view and they're not being listened to. So I want to change that. But now let's get to the interview. This is the first interview that I've ever done with four guests. So let's see how it goes. Today we will be remembering Michael Eleanor of HEAL, Health Education Action Liaison from New York City, with his friends Celia Farber, Joan Shenton, Tom DiFernando, and Bud Weiss. Tom wrote in an obituary he's preparing, "Michael Eleanor, Titan Warrior of HEAL, Master Hypnotherapist and Passionate Quintessential Angel of Hope, who raised hell to promote heaven on earth, has died. He is survived by his son and daughter, John Michael and Alexandra, and his daughter's mother, Pat Lynn." I personally only knew Michael later and learned that he was a critical presence in the early days of AIDS, particularly in New York City, when he and others who worked with him represented the non-pharmaceutical branch of AIDS treatment, or as time went on, rejection of the whole HIV/AIDS dogma. He helped many people in New York City recover without AIDS drugs through better health and other modalities. Welcome to the show, Celia, Joan, Tom, and Bud.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
So maybe the four of you can first introduce yourselves and indicate how and when you first met Michael. So I'll do it in the order that you show up on the screen. So we'll start with Bud.
Well, I first met Michael in, I think it was 1984, when I came to a HEAL meeting in New York City. Having found it because of the work that I'd done in cancer previously, and found out that they were, this group HEAL was talking about similar things as a critique of what was going on that I'd seen in cancer. And when I walked into the room, Michael was there and all of the original board of HEAL, and gosh, it must have been 60 or 70 or 80 people in that room. This was at the old Gay Men's Health Crisis place. And so I said, I'm home. This is where I want to be. Because I was running into such insanity in the schools where I was working about AIDS, and I knew it was wrong. And so that was when I first met Michael. And we've been having fun ever since, until this last, you know, year, in which it's been a really hard time for him.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, Joan Shenton, we'll take you next.
Well, I first heard about Michael because in the early days, when I first met Peter Duesberg, and with Jad Adams, we were working on our documentary called AIDS, The Unheard Voices. I heard that Michael had invited Peter to go over to speak in New York to HEAL New York. And he went. And then after that, I got to know more about HEAL New York. And then the most important moment, the enduring memory I have of Michael, is when we went to film for the documentary called AZT Cause for Concern. That was for Channel 4 Dispatches. I always see Michael as the true Good Samaritan. He told me that he saw so many young men dying in New York that were taking the very high doses of AZT, and in fact, that killed a whole generation of gay men, 2,000 milligrams and more a day. He felt that he had to help them. So he founded, together with others, HEAL New York. Now, Michael Eleanor, Frank Bernakis, Tom DiFernando, and there are some other names, Tom, that you will remind me of, formed HEAL New York and tried to help people who were suffering the most devastating side effects from AZT. Now, we took a film crew over to a HEAL New York meeting. And people at the meeting were describing how they had suffered unbearable side effects. I mean, unbearable headaches, the dizziness, nausea, fingernails turning black. And there was this young man called Alan Rountree, whom I'll never forget. And he said, the main thing was that you couldn't listen to people because you didn't want to hear them because you were hurting so bad. He became impotent and he said, it destroyed my hopes for living. And 2 weeks after our interview with him, he died. So that was Michael the Good Samaritan.
Okay. Thank you, Joan. Tom.
Yes. The question was, when did I first meet Michael?
Yeah. And when and how did you first meet Michael?
I think it was about 1991. Yeah, it was 1991, and I actually found him through Peter Duesberg. I had a client. I'm a pain, injury, stress, and trauma therapist, and I had a client who had an AIDS diagnosis and wanted to know if I knew any alternative doctors, you know, who knew the Duesbergian view. So I said, no, I don't, but I'll call Duesberg. I didn't know him. So I called him, and as most people say, you know, he's extremely personable. I think I spent almost an hour on the phone.
If you can get him on the phone, he'll talk a long time.
Yeah, maybe now, but that time I got him on the phone. And basically he said, you know, in terms of physicians, go see Michael Ellner at Heal. I said, okay. Yeah. So that's what I did. I went to a Heal meeting, had very similar experience to what Bud just described of, you know, you really feel at home because there was something, some of this, a lot of this is going to be difficult for me, so you'll have to hang in with me here.
Yeah, no, we understand that you were very close, and it's okay.
Yeah, we did a send off to him 5 years ago when he moved to Florida, and I guess I have to kind of interject this, and I was trying to describe what Heal was for me, and I remember there was a time when I went out to Bryce Canyon in Utah. And you're driving down this road, and it's just a forested area, and it's very lovely, but no big deal. And you're driving and driving, 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 and suddenly you come to this vast canyon, this amazing view, tremendous. And you suddenly have this experience of, oh my God, where did this come from? Who put this here? You know, such a contrast to everything else. Well, that for me was Heal. I mean, on an emotional, a psycho-spiritual, an intellectual, a scientific, I mean, on every level, it hit all the points that I needed hit and was what I was where I was coming from as an individual. I didn't have any health issues. I wasn't dealing with any AIDS-related stuff. I actually came into AIDS as a result of my interest in, like I said, the social, psychosocial type components. And for me, AIDS was a way to put the light on this whole bigger social context, which made this type of a crisis possible. So I went into Heal with that with that background, and completely resonated. It felt so perfect. And I think in the second meeting, I gave Michael a copy of an essay I had written that was later called Dirty Words, The AIDS Fraud in Context. And Michael told me subsequently, years later, he said, you know, when I read that, I said, you know, this guy belongs here, you know. We can use what he's offering. So, and then the, you know, the love affair, you know.
So, right. So to speak. Yes. Celia, how did you meet Michael and when?
So, it was either 1987, I think 1987. And I was, just at the beginning of My AIDS work began in 1986, my AIDS journalism, with a and I dove right into the the fire, I guess. It was actually, I don't know if any of you remember, an alternative treatment called AL-721 that was very popular at the time. It was the first counter narrative to AZT, and I was very naive, I guess, at the time. And I was one of those who absolutely believed that it was that simple, that if people just took AL-721, they would be fine. I feel like now, after all these decades, it's really important for me to stress that, my God, Michael and his take on it was the most critical. I always knew that, but I think I always thought, well, there's the science side, and then there's the psychosomatic side, and they all play in. And now I feel much more like the psychosomatic side that Michael was so prescient about, so prescient, so prophetic about, wound up being by far the most important of the aspect of it. But it was also the most difficult to break. And he always said that. Many of us have said that in different ways. But that was Michael's poetic space, you know, domain. He said things that now are so resonant. Most, I've been thinking about it a lot lately, just the bone, the way he got that bone, that big plastic bone, and visualized the idea of the bone pointing. And I remember when I still thought, oh, well, you know, there's not really voodoo, is there? And, you know, of course, again, I've learned the hard way. So I guess I met Michael for the first time, let's call it 1987. I was in I went to a HEAL meeting to cover it as a journalist. And I remember the light bulb hanging in the ceiling. Do you remember that, Bud or Tom? There was this one light bulb that hung down, and that was my metaphor that I ran with in the lead about this room and this light bulb and these people, if they could just make it into this room. There was this man who told them they didn't need to die, and it was incredibly dramatic and brave, you know. It was like what it was, like a war, and he was just trying to get people out of the fire. And I remember feeling like in that room people were safe in that room, but not necessarily when they went back out into the world again. It was more complicated than that. But in that great feeling of safety, thanks to Michael.
You brought up the psychosocial aspects. He came up with the term the AIDS zone. Mm. And I remember, I don't exactly know what happened, but somebody else he thought, misusing this term, and he got a little bit protective about it. But I thought the term the AIDS zone kind of summarized that aspect of the psychological aspect of people that got into it. I mean, what was your take on what he meant by the AIDS zone?
Who are you asking?
Anybody. So Tom, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. The AIDS zone was definitely a psychosocial, socio-emotional place where whatever your pre-existing tensions or inner conflicts of life were, that it, whatever degree they weren't resolved, it would make you susceptible to a concept that would completely disempower you and make you make choices that are the absolute worst, if you're looking to improve your situation. Michael would describe it as a kind of a hex, because he was a hypnotherapist. But it's a real condition of people. I mean, my background's Wilhelm Reich. I look at what Reich called armoring, which is, you know, where the rigidities in the body and the mind, protective defenses that you have, you know, they're binding up all this energy that you're not even conscious is there. And yet the more there, the more susceptible you are, like I said, to not only making choices that are not in your best interest, but making choices that in the face of a crisis will cause you to escalate the crisis, and try to push it to a climax where you get a substitute sense of satisfaction without fundamentally changing anything except possibly for the worse.
And one of the aspects, I think, is an unwillingness to consider other ideas. It's impossible.
That's right.
Yeah, Joan, your take on it.
On the AIDS zone, I looked up an email Michael wrote on the 2nd of February 2015, and he was explaining what he meant by the AIDS zone. I remember distinctly seeing him waving that bone in Buenos Aires at the AIDS dissident conference there. And I always thought it was a real bone. It wasn't, was it?
No, it was plastic.
It was plastic.
And half the bone.
Sorry.
We're looking for it.
And he said the aid zone is a mass self-hypnotic trance. And people who believe in the AIDS infectious hypothesis it's a kind of cultural self-hypnosis. People didn't dare speak out against the infectious hypothesis because the results could become catastrophic. So there you are. That's what he wrote.
My sense, I think Mike...
Bud, go ahead.
Sometimes, is that what had been created largely by the CDC and pharmaceuticals, as well as pushed by those people, most largely in the gay men's group, who were terrified because this is where it was happening, large, mm-hmm. And while it was happening also largely in the drug community, they didn't have a voice, certainly not a voice like what the gay men had. Mm-hmm. So it was this terror pushing all of it. And so what had been created was a cult. It was like a religious cult that if you didn't believe in this, you would die. But you would die anyways, but you would die amongst the faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And so Michael had a real bone to pick with all of that, of course.
A bone to pick, yes.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Michael did so magnificently, and he and I had many arguments about it, is that in the meetings, he would literally, in certain ways, put everybody into a trance. So people would come away from those meetings moved and feeling like there was real hope, that there was hope in their lives. And of course, many people would speak up in the meetings, including... I can't think of his name right now, who gone through many crises with us and was one of the longest lived people. He's with us in Heal, and we went to Canada with us.
Tony. You're talking about Tony?
No, not Tony. Anyway.
Frank Bonarkas.
No, Frank was one of the original people who really was...
Roberto. You're thinking of Roberto.
Not Roberto. Well, he went to Canada with... Anyway. Now I forgot my point. People would relate their stories of how things changed and changed for them. And when Christine was involved, it was like one story after another of people breaking out of the braid zone, out of that intense belief system. And that began to provide an alternative set of beliefs in people who were surviving. And that was crucial. And Michael was consistently able to generate that space. And so one of the things he would say, which really pissed me off, although I felt that way at the beginning, was Michael would say, and fire your doctor, change your doctor and fire your doctor. It was like this thing against doctors. And my experience had been that doctors were just caught in the same thing. And many of them were these young doctors who were operating in the emergency rooms. They didn't know what the hell to do. And when I'd go into the emergency room to try to be helpful to some people, I'd see the confusion and the terror in these doctors' faces. And I said, we don't need to be at war against the doctors. Against the CDC? Yeah, because it's a totally corrupt organization.
Mm-hmm.
And against the essence of what happens in the pharmaceuticals? Yes, because they've become completely corrupted. I think Joan's challenge, AZT cause for concern, Joan, were you challenged Burroughs Welcome at the end of the film and said, and if you think I'm lying, sue me. Well, they didn't sue you, but they blocked anything happening after that with their...
Well, they tried to injunct the program, but Channel right. 4 lifted the injunction.
But Michael was out there with that. When his voice message answered the call to Heal phone, the end of it would be, and fire your doctor.
Yes. How did Michael get involved in the whole AIDS catastrophe? As far as I know, he wasn't a gay man. What was it that got him involved?
I'm not sure, but maybe Michael, but. Michael had gone through some health crises for himself earlier on, and he had begun to really look into alternative medicine because he had gone through his own crises. By the way, Tom, if you do this thing that you're writing, please be sure to include his stuff about being a dog trainer.
Actually, I had a note for that, and I didn't include that. But
Michael was astounding as a trainer of animals.
Really?
In fact, before he was involved with AIDS and the rest of stuff, he was on Wall Street, and he just had it with Wall Street. So he left Wall Street, and he got involved with other things. One of them was his talent he knew he had for communicating with animals. It was astounding. I mean, astounding. And he wrote a series of small books. He became an animal trainer, trained people to help be in charge of their animals, dogs in particular. And he wrote 3 or 4 books, which were prize-winning little books for working with animals. And I'm going to tell a quick anecdote about that. So one day, Michael's coming over to my apartment in Brooklyn where I had stored all the Heal archives and everything else. And we're going to have to go through them and deal with them and whatever else. And at the time, I was living with my girlfriend at the time. And so she had this massive Russian guard dog. I mean, it was called a Russian mountain dog or something. This huge, 120 pounds. When he'd stand up, his head was over my head. Beautiful, gorgeous dog, but a one family dog. And when everybody came to visit, we would have to lock Beethoven. That was his name. We'd have to lock Beethoven in the other room. And so Michael's coming to visit. I said, Michael, when you get here, you ring the bell. Just wait. We have to put Beethoven in the other room. He said, don't do it. I said, what are you talking about? This animal's dangerous. Beautiful animal. He's dangerous. He'll kill somebody. He almost tore me apart once. And Michael says, don't do it. Michael, he says, don't do it. So he rang the bell downstairs, and Beethoven barked a few times. And up comes Michael, and he knocks on the door, and Beethoven stopped. And he looked at the door. And I said, Michael, something's happening. He says, I told you, just let him alone. He'll be fine. Michael comes in the door, sits down, and Beethoven came over and put his head in Michael's lap.
Wow.
I had never seen anything like that. Michael didn't say a word. He said, I told you, I have this ability to communicate with animals. So there was a sort of magic that Michael tapped into way back to our ancestors who could talk with the animals, who could communicate with them. He had that ability, and it got reflected in some of the work he did in hypnosis. But it would just blow your mind to see that.
Yes. Can somebody talk about his work as a hypnotherapist, and how did that connect with his work with AIDS?
I'll use that as a segue also to answer your first question. As much as I remember the story, Michael was doing, he also had some interest in acting, and he was doing something for some reason. I think he had a friend at the Michael Chekhov studio in New York. And when he was there, you know, back in 1983 or something like that, I think one of the guys was dying of this thing, AIDS or something like that. And when he was looking into what is that, he heard, now remember, he has the hypnotherapy background. He heard this idea that this AIDS is always fatal. That was the thing that was being perpetuated. And that was the turning point for him, because he said, wait a minute, nothing's ever always fatal. Nothing in history, even the worst plagues were never always fatal.
Mm-hmm.
Survivors. So he knew that. And then when he was hearing, you know, always fatal, always fatal, always fatal, there was the repetition, you know, like the hypnosis of that. He said, something's wrong about this. And I don't remember exactly what the link was to get him to heal, but somehow he got to heal, felt he could contribute that component. And then within a year, he took over as the president and, you know, steered the wheel, you know, quite dramatically from there on.
Well, heal started in 1982. And Michael came in shortly after its start. And they had a lot of publicity that was out there because they were very accepted in the alternative versions about what to do about it. People were referring people to us all the time from all over the place, from the gay men's health crisis, from this place, from that place. We were having people referred all the time until we came out after Duisberg's paper and said, wait a minute, HIV is not the cause of AIDS. Then we became anathema. Then we were people who were teaching people to eat their shit and drink their pee, which, by the way, well, we won't go into that.
I mean,
that was the killer. At that point, people not only didn't refer to us, they were vilifying us all over the place, and it was pretty ugly. But before that, there was a lot going on. You could find it. back before 19, when was Duisberg's paper? 89?
87, I think. I mean, 87 was also the year that AZT came out, which is when the big money started in AIDS.
Yeah. So before that, we had lots of people coming. Meetings would be over 100 people sometimes.
Yeah, just to interject also a little more detail at the beginning, in 1982, it was a group of gay men who were organized around macrobiotics as an approach to illness. So there was already an antiviral, or, you know, the anti-microbe theory type of view kind of in there. And the popularity was through, they had the Whole Foods Project and all that stuff. And so that was, and it was Michael and Frank who I think started bringing in more of the science and started shifting it into more of an activist and support group. It wasn't that originally, it was a group of people interested in macrobiotics.
Celia, do you want to add anything?
Yeah. Quiet. Always with me, there's so many thoughts and they go off in different directions. But about, I was watching a bit, just a little anecdote. I was actually on YouTube looking into urine therapy. I do a lot of looking at, I've been investigating in recent years for myself and others that are close to me, solutions to a spectrum of diseases that are connected to, like we used to call it immune suppression with AIDS. I think we've all gotten a little more sophisticated now that we realize there's a spectrum in the middle that almost come together as one disease, which is, some call it chronic fatigue syndrome, adrenal collapse, leads to depression, PTSD, so on and so forth. So researching that, one of the things I've been researching is actually urine therapy, which I wrote a piece about. I'm going to be sorry you brought this up, bud. I wrote an AIDS column about it at around 1988 or something. And I don't know if you all remember, Kike Palladino was the head of that faction about urine therapy. Anyway, I was watching a documentary about it the other night, and within the first minute and a half, there was a meeting, somebody was talking about urine therapy, and there was Michael suddenly sitting there, and he had a look on his face like, it's, you know, that look he had where you just didn't really know what he was thinking, but it was kind of, I really should have sent it to you guys at the time because I tried to find it last night. It was just a hilarious Michael Ellner classic expression on his face. Urine therapy is very effective against a host of diseases, but we won't argue about that now. Anyway, what else?
Well, there's a doctor in Houston, Dr. Brzezinski, who's created a cancer therapy, and originally the peptides that he used were purified from urine, so it's not that far out there. Now they're synthesized separately, but it's not such a far out idea. But they will use anything against you when the idea is to sell drugs.
Yeah, Martin Lehrer, who took over Pat, one of the things that happened with Palladino is he got terrified. And Palladino was one of the first people to come to heal and prepare.
Yeah, he died, and that was why I thought simplistically at the time urine therapy didn't work, but I don't think that anymore. But
He got terrified and he started using AZT, didn't tell anybody.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah. But then Martin Lehrer heard about it, and Martin is a plumber, a brilliant guy, and Martin thought, this is really interesting, and that and ozone he was looking into. And so Martin started to really take it over and did the research and published, I still have two or three copies of that book, published a book about urine therapy. I can't remember the exact name, but he really went into the whole history of it, back to Egypt and how it had been recommended, and then the aspects of Ayurveda and how they used urine. So that's pretty old and very interesting.
Forgive me, I didn't mean to cut you off. It's just something came to me sorry, did I interrupt you, bud?
No, it's all right. Go ahead. Anybody can interrupt me if they can.
Heal was operating in the dark ages of our understanding of healing and medicine, not forget medicine, healing and the human body. We all were. And it was so brave of all of you, really, to do this, because there was just no, it was just the dark, it was, it, I, when I think back on it now, if only we had what we have today with, today, none of these ideas are even particularly controversial. They really aren't. I mean, now it's kind of incredibly backward people that don't understand mind-body connection, that don't understand the importance of self-acceptance and eliminating terrorizing messages and making sure that you don't expose yourself to deadly toxins. And all these ideas are just so basic now, don't you think, that they're basic, they're accepted?
Well, I agree with you that they are, it's changing, but it's still sadly massively still driven by the input of the pharmaceuticals and vaccines and all the rest of it. But again, Michael would deliver the message in a way, and so I would back off in the meetings and let him just deliver the message that way, because he was so effective in doing it that he would literally hypnotize people into beginning to believe that there was hope and that there was a possibility.
Well, he used a few things.
Michael had a brilliant mind. Whenever I was in doubt about something, I would call Michael up and say, well, where do I find the reference to blah, 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 blah? And Michael would immediately think of the person's name, the place to look for it. He didn't have a photographic memory, but it was so synced in because of his intense desire to be of help to people that he had all that stuff right on the tip of his tongue. It was amazing. And so in the meetings, when somebody would ask a question, it would be right there. Or we would have a resource person in the room who could answer the question better as Michael led into that resource person speaking.
How important was information to dealing with the fear that was driving people into the AIDS zone? You know, information in terms of critical analysis of the science or some of the conflicts of interest, that kind of
thing. You guys must have spent a fortune on photocopying, because I remember those photocopied, you know, stacks that were handed out at HEAL meetings. Good God, how old are we? It was before the internet.
Believe me, it cost a lot of money. We had this cheap place where we had each page was printed for 3 cents a page. And I would take them there, and they would do it overnight, and we'd get these huge packets that you're talking about at 3 cents a page. So whatever it was, I don't know how many pages. Tom, what was it, about 200 pages or something like that?
Well, it was about almost an inch thick, but yeah. that was after I went through and retyped all the original papers, which had been copied over so many times, it was unreadable. You couldn't even do the optical character recognition.
Right. Can I ask her a question very quickly?
Yes.
I'm really impressed, Bud, when you said that HEAL had started in 1982. So you were there in 82.
No, I wasn't. I came in 1984.
So that was before HIV was talked about. So HEAL was obviously there to offer alternative therapies to people, mainly gay men, I assume, who were suffering illness from perhaps recreational drug use.
Well, that was before the atomic bomb, before the press conference. That was before
May 1984, Gallows press conference.
So remember, 82, there must have been people needing HEAL New York for many reasons that did not involve the word HIV.
That's right. It started, well, first they had GRID, remember, before it was even called AIDS. And then once it was called AIDS, you know, HEAL came shortly after that. But like I said, even though there was no viral thing going on, these guys were coming from a holistic and macrobiotic perspective in the first place. In macrobiotics, there's no such thing as an incurable disease. So right up front, trying to convince people that it was built into HEAL from the start to question any concept that would completely disempower you, when you had a group of people who, just from a food perspective, were all about empowerment as premier.
You know. And what were some of the techniques used to try to shut down HEAL and Michael and the other people involved?
Our lives were threatened.
That'll do it.
People followed me after meetings. You know, they would follow me, menacing me after meetings. And Michael was a street tough. Michael said he didn't care. Let him come on. I'll beat the shit out of him. I mean, it was really ugly. And we'd show up at some of these open meetings, and they would talk us down. They would stop us from talking. Celia, you must have, God only knows how badly you've been attacked. For the work, the extraordinary work that you...
My trauma syndrome has functioned well because it's erased so much of the history. I just don't remember a lot of it. I don't remember the details. I just remember a big cloud of continuous agony and terror, basically, and never really knowing what we were guilty of, but knowing that we were guilty, sentenced, hung, and... Yeah. And being so grateful, I do remember being so grateful for you guys, and I felt guilty that I was always so caught up with spin and the column I always had to produce, so I didn't go to Heal meetings that often. When I went, I felt really it was probably for me also as a journalist, not understanding yet that I was also in the AIDS zone, that it was also trying to kill me. And kill my sense of self-worth, which is what I think AIDS is. It's a thing that wants to destroy people's self-worth. So it's like an anti-Christ paradigm. I regret so much that I didn't find time to go to more Heal meetings. But I'm also astounded along with I didn't, if you had asked me when did it start, I would never have known that it was 1982. That's incredibly early.
You were present in the meetings, Celia, because we quoted your articles and pointed people to read the stuff that you'd written. That and the two theses in Mother, those were so powerful for women. I don't want to go into the stories about me with the parents and children and the horrors that I saw going on. But your papers were life-saving for a lot of people. Those ones in Mothering Magazine, they were just absolutely spot on. And again, you had mothers testifying to their experience. I'll tell you how bad it was. I forget which Newsweek or Newsday article it was, but there was an article in there where Bill Clinton called us a threat to national security. And when we saw that, all of us went, oh my God.
I remember that.
Yeah, what?
Chuck Ortlieb was very upset about that, and he said that we should all be prepared to potentially, as threats to American national security, be sent to some sort of military prison.
It was terrifying.
Chuck was not the most reassuring person, that's for sure. I don't mean to speak in
I'm trying to remember. I can't think of his name. He died. It's under mysterious circumstances, and they tried to say that he died of AIDS. I'm blanking on his name.
Was he part of Heal?
No, he was at Heal. He died just before I got there. I filled in some of that gap. I can't believe I'm forgetting his name too. But I wanted to your question, David, about different ways they were trying to shut down. There was one way a little less dramatic than some of the stories. And Celia, by the way, I concur with Bud, you were definitely one of the real heroes in AIDS. I mean, there was even a mystique about you, but in a good way. Celia Farber was the one journalist. I mean, Neville Hodgkinson and Joan Shenton, of course, were there too, but certainly in New York City, your contribution was absolutely essential. But an example of the shutting down, I remember going to a meeting at the GMHC with Michael. There was a big meeting of all the AIDS hotlines in New York City. And there were probably about 20 places being represented there that day. And Michael and I were going there explicitly to challenge, at the time, the whole prophylaxing concept. So this was, I think, 1993, where they were suddenly saying, okay, it's time to start taking antibiotics the rest of your life to prevent pneumonia. And they were using a study that evidently claimed there was benefit to support that claim. When we looked at the study, of course, in the abstract, it said there was this benefit. But when you actually read the paper, it was a complete contradiction of the abstract, that in fact, the people who were prophylaxing got way more secondary infections and opportunistic infections. And like 50% of them were still dying off anyway. So it was a complete contradiction. So anyway, we went into that meeting And most of these people were still a little bit friendly with you all the time. I mean, they didn't like, they were actually in some ways a little iffy about HIV and the testing. They kind of tolerated us, even tolerated us speaking out against AZT. But then when we came out protesting the prophylaxis concept, I just remember the one guy, I'm forgetting his name now too, just getting hysterical and going, "That's it, no more. We cannot send people to heal anymore." And it was decided all the AIDS hotlines, there was a complete cutoff. And that was in 1993. And right then was when the HEAL meetings, which were regularly 60, 70, 80 people every single Wednesday, even on holidays. I mean, we did them all. Or actually maybe Christmas and New Year's, I think we did, and on Wednesdays. But otherwise, every week, you'd have these people and directly coordinated. You saw how many people they were feeding to us, because the number dropped almost in half right around that time. So that was one of the...
I'm gonna have to go, but can I just read a few lines that Michael wrote?
Sure. We should probably all start our final comments, because we have about 10 minutes left. So yeah, why don't you start that process, Joan?
In this email, which he wrote not long ago in 2015, when he's explaining about the AIDS zone, he's saying that the people that can't leave the AIDS zone become hopelessly inured and dependent on the AIDS zone. And this is why the HIVists attack Duisberg, Farber, et al. It is far more than just covering their asses. They're protecting their religion. And at some level, they know that they can't handle the truth. I believe that we're dealing with a society that is heavily invested in protecting the HIV/AIDS paradigm without being aware of it. It's a matter of national and personal security. And then he goes on and he ends the paragraph, all of these people are likely to be in the AIDS zone and unconsciously protecting themselves from anything and everything that exposes HIV and infectious AIDS.
Wow.
Yes.
Thanks, Joan.
Let me follow up on that, because that's final.
Yes, but.
One, my best friend, I'm not going to say who he was a very fine physician. He kept on saying to me, "I don't know why you're talking this way." And my niece, who's actually an exceptional physician, so I'd try to talk to them, and they would say, "You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're talking about. You should stop doing that." And I recognized that what had happened, because each one of them had recommended people to take the medications and had seen them die, like the one person who came to our meetings, who used to use our meetings to get more people. We didn't know it at the time. He actually used our meetings to grab more people and put them on medication. That these people had felt a deep sense of investment in what they had done, because they know that what they had done was not effective, and they could not hear that what they had done was possibly killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens over and over again in medicine. Good people, meaning to do well, discover that they have been doing something that has been harming people, and it is so hard to backtrack. So hard to backtrack. And the people who do are heroes to me. The ones who can actually say, "Wait a minute, I was wrong. I actually harmed people and killed people, but I know better now, and I'm changing, and I'm going to, you know, find a way to get there." And so that's how powerful it is. It's driven not just by the initial belief system, but I've continued investment in keeping it be this way it is, because I cannot face what I've done to people when I thought that it was, that, you know, HIV was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's huge. I mean, it took Neville Hutchinson 2 years. Neville Hutchinson, the chief science editor of the London Sunday Times,
yeah.
2 years before he came out, because he could not believe that all of the stuff that he had heard about publicly was real. He couldn't believe it.
Yes.
And once he did, and he came out saying what he did, they basically pushed him out of the time.
Yes. Yes.
So,
Tom.
I'll jump in. Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple things points I wanted to hit on, since this is about Michael, is that I was trying to think of a few keys to understanding Michael Ellner, you know, because he was a controversial figure in a lot of ways too, while absolutely mesmerizing and inspiring. One was that he hated deception and betrayal. For example, when he was a child, I remember him always talking about, he was furious when he found out that he was lied to about Santa Claus. Starting early. In terms of betrayal, he would also speak out how horrified he was when he realized that he had been circumcised. He would say, what kind of person would do that to somebody? You know, to which I would joke, it's a good thing the doctor who circumcised him didn't do it wearing a Santa Claus suit, but that's a different had to put in something light. Another really important story he would point out is that, you know, in a growing up in a Jewish family, the Holocaust was always being talked about. You know, never forget, always remember. So he took that to heart. And when he would bring up AIDS and what was going on and the way people were being killed, he was furious that nobody would take that seriously. He saw everybody as a hypocrite. You know, I mean, Jews and non-Jews, anybody. So that was important to understand. I wanted to point out he was never so at home as he was at a HEAL meeting. I mean, that just like Bud and I talking about how home we were, boy, was Michael just, he was at home there. He was, you know, helping people with catastrophic illness, coaching them through it with confidence and clarity and compassion. It was just so inspiring. So you had this combination of helping people and righting a wrong simultaneously. And Michael Ellner was really the king at carrying that banner and bringing people forward in a way that I think a thing that applied to him, I remember a guy saying to me once, he said, you know, Tom, I think what moves me so much about this, because it's so confusing and contradictory, is your conviction. Your conviction moves me so deeply. I see the truth in what you're saying. And that was HEAL, and HEAL centered on Michael. You know, the conviction came out of real clarity. David, you asked about, you know, if information helped people. It did. I just wanted to also mention that was one of the things that was unique about HEAL. We felt information was not enough because there was this whole psychosocial.
Yes.
With complete respect, and we loved all the help, you know, what all the scientists were contributing, but felt that they were missing, that they thought it was just a matter of you had to sit down with Laurie Garrett and explain to her what was going on. Forget it. There's an emotional need for this crisis.
Right.
And until you address that, you can't understand HIV, you can't get out of the AIDS zone, you can't recover your health. And
I think that's one thing I learned probably from Michael Ellner, being a science-oriented person. I had to learn that it was a lot more than that. The science was not enough. Celia, yeah, some final words.
One of the tools that Michael used was anger. And that was actually also present in the, you know, like Larry Kramer, we don't agree with his take on things and what he did, but he used anger and he said, I'm yelling because I want people to wake up. And Michael used a combination of humor, anger, and there was something at his core that was very relaxed and kind of good humored about it, everything. He was reassuring, but he did yell. There was volume that was intended, I now understand, to wake people up. Sometimes I found it a little traumatizing, but I understand now why he was doing it. And I came to think of a historical hero that I'm sure you all know about. Raoul Wallenberg was stationed in Budapest during the war, and he invented, just like Michael did, out of nowhere, a way to just rescue Hungarian Jews. And he did, one of the things he used to do is show up at the train stations in Budapest with a completely invented authority, saying these, screaming at the he would get up on a couple of crates and just yell at the Nazi commanders there and say, these people all belong to me. They're under Swedish sovereign, whatever it was. And people were frozen, about to go into the trains. And he would say, I don't have all day. How many of you have Swedish diplomatic passports? No such thing existed, but they got and they all started raising their hands, and just took them away into Swedish neutral territory, which was his. I think about that a lot, and I always used to think about Michael that way. I used to think, how does he know? How does he have the confidence? And it was like, it didn't matter, because the number one thing was to get people you know, just to safety. Don't get on those trains.
Get out of the eighth zone.
Yeah.
No, I want to add one more thing here.
Okay.
On one occasion, Michael and I were driving to see a wonderful friend of mine to talk to him about some things out in Long Island. And I got lost trying to find the place. And I said, Michael, we're lost. And Michael turned to me and he said, listen, knowing where you're going is well overrated. And it was like being present. That was the most important thing. And I think part of his ability to really hang in there no matter what, and I mean no matter what, was that he was present. Michael really was present wherever he was around this stuff. Despite all of the discouragement and things that happened around everything, he was really present. And yeah, I miss him terribly, as I'm sure everyone here does. He was a dear, dear friend. We would commiserate with one another about all kinds of stuff, having nothing to do with AIDS, and talk with one another and have fun. And he was a lot of fun, a great sense of humor, and just we had a lot of fun kidding around together. So,
Tom, I think you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to piggyback on that, Bud, on that the part of him being so centered. What I always experienced, even before I knew him well, just was how friggin' positive he was, which was always ironic because we were dealing with so-called positivity. He was, there was something in his energy. You know, he was just so positive. I mean, everything had hope in it. There was no such thing as an unsolvable, you know, situation. There was just a way of figuring out how to do it. He had that confidence. He exuded it every moment. And I think that was part of what was so special about him.
And can I just say, Jay, one last thing, even though we're out of time?
Yes. It's overtime now.
Go.
I think Michael was, I think it's very important that we try to, Tom, I read your piece and I thought it was fantastic and I'd like to publish it at the Truth Barrier. We'll talk about that afterwards. But I think Michael was hurt and felt that Keel's historical role had been kind of lost in everything was lost in this war, but maybe now that things have settled somewhat, we can set things right. I mean, Tom, you know what I'm talking about. I hope it's not wrong to say that, but Michael was hurt by the fact that people didn't seem to understand it before there was anything to feel. And that's, he really deserves, you all deserve so much more credit than you've gotten for being there when there was no there was nothing. It was a desert.
Thank you
all for joining me today. I think it's a good way to remember Michael Ellner.
Thank you, David, for the opportunity.
Thank you, David, for putting
thank
this together.
Thank you for organizing it, David. Brilliant.
Okay, goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Celia. Bye.
Bye. Bye, Michael.
Bye, everyone. Bye, Michael.
Thanks for listening to episode 177 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for future guests, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com.